Hello. Oh my gosh, we are back. IPVME is back. I'm so excited. Guys, I'm so sorry. I had intended to take a break back in November. I was heading into my busy season at work, which is usually from like November to maybe mid-January. And then it just kind of ended up being an extended break. Firstly, I had a lot going on. And then I was just a little bit kind of drained from life, and I didn't really have the motivation to record. And I feel like for me, with these stories that I tell, I very much want to, you know, these women deserve to have their stories told, but to be told well. And I felt like me not being in the best headspace, I wouldn't have been able to give fully to those stories. And, you know, I want to be able to do that. So I feel like when I'm not having a good day and I'm not feeling motivated, I can't really bring a whole lot to the plate. So I just wanted to wait till I was feeling a bit more alive, a bit more clear-headed, which I am now. And honestly, in the last like probably 2 months, I feel like it's the best that I've felt in years. You guys know I had a lot of health issues in the last year, in particular, last kind of couple of years, realistically. And so first of all, we had some like shakeups in my job around the end of January. So I'm kind of like nothing major, but like I'm in a different department, and I feel like physically, you guys know I had a horse riding accident last year, which I have chronic pain from now. So honestly, like just that little switch up at work has changed how I feel physically so much. I'm not doing as much like bending or like heavy lifting anymore, which has helped hugely. I also, another thing I don't know if this was like a TikTok trend or something, but I've been seeing Hoka sneakers, I think that's how you pronounce it, everywhere. I've seen the stores pop up everywhere. I keep seeing like where I work, it's our customers are very much tourist heavy, and like all the tourists are wearing them, and then everybody at work started wearing them. So I was like, you know what, I'm gonna buy a pair. They're supposed to be like, you know, designed for like walking all day, or like, you know, you're in jobs where you're standing all day, and they have like sneakers that are, you know, you do like a little quiz thing and they cater like which sneakers work best for like your circumstances. So I bought a pair like probably a month ago now, and honestly, like they have changed my life, and I'm not just exaggerating. Like I went from like within the space of half an hour at my job, and I stand all day at my job, not to mention like the commuting back and forth as well, and I instantly like would have back pain, which, you know, we all get back pain, leg pain from standing if you're in a job or on your feet all day. But I have what's it called, discogenic disease on my back, and I have like you know, I broke my rib and I broke several bones in my spine, and so I have like that added pain also. And like I have barely felt that since I got these sneakers, and I don't get leg pain anymore. It's like walking on air, honestly. I can't even tell you how amazing they are. I'm like a spokesperson for them now, unofficially, because I've been telling everybody I know to buy them. And yeah, so I've been feeling great physically, and that I do not have anywhere near as much pain as I used to have. I still have pain, but nowhere near as much. And it's not so like excruciating anymore. And then also, so I got really sick. You guys know I get sick a lot anyway. If you're a long time listener to this podcast, you definitely for sure know that. And I had a really bad viral infection in February. So I thought I had the flu first. And I had COVID not that long before that, maybe like 2 or 3 weeks before that. I thought it was just like, oh, I'm getting like, because, you know, I've heard of people having COVID and then a few weeks later they get like symptoms back again. And I thought that was what happened to me. And it got so bad. Like I had a fever on and off for 5 days straight. I literally was in like the worst condition I feel like I ever was in my entire life. Like I felt like I was dying. Like I was just completely out of it. I was in pain. I felt horrendous. The worst sickness I think I've ever had in my life, honestly. And I get a lot of illnesses. This was like torture to me. So I did like the FaceTime call with the doctor because I was not physically able to go to a doctor's office, and she thought that I had flu, and told me, you know, when I was able to actually go see an in-person doctor. And like, there were so many days where I was like, no, I need to go to the emergency room. Like I need to go. But I just wasn't physically able. Now, if I'm thinking that, I'm the kind of person where like my arm could be hanging off and I'd be like, ah, it's fine. I'll just put a little bandage on and I'll be okay. I'm that person. Like I very rarely go to the doctor. But if I'm thinking, okay, I need to go to the ER, it's bad. I just felt horrific. I was mentally like just in the worst place. It was awful. Once the fever stopped, I went to the doctor, and that's when she told me I had a viral infection in my upper respiratory. It was, oh my God, it was so bad. So she gave me medication. I also had a really bad cough, and then the cough set off the pain again that I have in my side from when I broke my rib last year. So I had that pain in my rib for, I'd say, about 6 weeks after that. Like, I was a mess. Didn't eat anything for 10 days. I was so weak. I lost a bunch of weight. When I went back to my first day at work after being off for, I was off for probably about 2 weeks, I'd say. I put my uniform on and like, honestly, it was hanging off me, and I was so pale. I just looked gaunt. Like I looked so bad. And then I had very last minute, only 2 weeks before, right before I got sick, booked a trip to Ireland for a week because I just got a like super, super, super cheap flight. You know, nobody's really traveling in February, I feel like. Definitely not back and forth from New York, because you have that period of, you know, so many Irish people live in New York. So then like a lot of them go home in December for Christmas, and then so they've just been there, and then a lot of people go back and forth in March as well for St. Patrick's Day. So I feel like February is just that like kind of weird in between. So like the flights are so cheap, there was nobody on my flight, the whole back of the plane to myself. And I was worried about traveling because I had only just started to feel it better, and it was only the day before that I had actually eaten for the first time after not eating for 10 days. So like I was very weak and I was a bit worried about traveling. I think it definitely helped that there was nobody sitting anywhere near me. That was magnificent. So I got to Ireland. I just wanted to like do nothing. I just wanted to chill. I literally followed my mom around for the whole week, her routine, what she does. I hung out with my nephews, and I actually had the best time. Like one of my best trips home to Ireland, I think. Like I just had a lovely, lovely, lovely time. And that just kind of, I think, brought me back to life a little bit. Like lovely beach walks and like just fresh air and like being around family. My nephews are so funny. They're just growing up so much now. And now they're like talking. So like my older nephew, who's almost 4, is like talking like a grown man. And then my younger nephew, like the last time I saw him, he wasn't even walking. So now he's walking and he's talking, and they're just so funny. So I just had the best time with them, and it was just really what I needed. And then when I came back, so I had a few days off before I had to go back to work, and I'm always in the, there's like a 5-hour time difference between New York and Ireland, so Ireland are 5 hours ahead. So usually for like a week or so when I get back, I'm like going to bed at 6 o'clock in the evening and then like wide awake at like 3 a.m. and I actually kind of like that routine. And like I get up at 3 a.m. too, and I'm just like having my breakfast and slowly like getting ready for the day. So I kind of wanted to not keep the routine of getting up at 3 a.m. because that's obviously not realistic. But I was like, you know what? I'm going to try my best, because I've never been a morning person. I'm going to try my best to like get up, you know, a few hours before I have to go to work, instead of getting up like, okay, what's the latest to the minute that I can stay in bed before I really, really have to go. And then I'm rushing to get ready. So I've been getting up at like usually I leave the house for work at like 8:45, so I would get up at 8 a.m. sometimes 8:15 if I could get away with it, and just rushing to get ready. So I've started getting up at like 5:30, 6 a.m. and honestly it's really changed, I feel like, my whole mentality. Like, I've been feeling mentally so well. I'm not tired anymore. I just have, like, I don't know, I just feel like this weirdly, like, new lease of life lately, and I feel so much better. And just that small little change has done wonders for me. So I've started kind of like getting out of the house more on my days off, doing a little bit more. I've been seeing a lot of my friends recently, which has been lovely because I hadn't seen them in a while. Again, like I was saying, I was so sick and I was at my busy season at work, so I never really see people around the winter time anyway. And I'm definitely a bit of a hibernator when in the winter time. I hate winter weather. So I've been feeling really good. The weather is kind of starting to get a little better in New York. It's, oh my God, the weather in New York has been horrendous for the last few months. It's just been like monsoon season, like every day, with little pockets of sunshine here and there. But it's been getting really good. So hoping it's finally officially springtime now. So it's been really nice. And yes, I also wanted to mention, I did something a few weeks ago that I'm so excited to tell you about, but it's gonna be part of the next episode and the next episode's story also. If you follow me on Instagram, you'll probably know what this is already. So I'm very excited about that. So anyways, enough out of me because I've been rambling for too long. So today's episode, you may have heard this on other podcasts. This was a really big story line when it happened, and I've always wanted to cover it. So I'm really excited today to tell you the story of Victoria Silliers. Victoria Silliers was born in Edinburgh in 1975. Her mother gave up her job as a nurse to be a stay-at-home mother to her and her brother Christopher while her father worked. When Victoria was 14, her parents told her her mother had bowel cancer. She was devastated and coped by distancing herself from it all. After a couple of years, they decided to head on a vacation to Hawaii as a family in what her father referred to as her last family holiday. He said if it was the last time they were all together, they wanted to make sure they created some happy memories. But if Victoria felt sick, she said she did not want to go. Her mother's face fell. She felt awful, but she wasn't ready to say goodbye to her mother and felt that if she didn't go, then she couldn't possibly die. She said there was a summer equestrian camp that she would go to instead. She knew her parents were heartbroken. Within weeks of returning from the vacation, her father announced that her mother had to be moved to a hospice. And in September, a month before Victoria's 16th birthday, they kissed their mother for the last time. One day, when Victoria was on her way to drum practice, she saw a poster on the school wall about partaking in a charity parachute jump. She thought it was exactly the kind of escape she needed, and she wanted to raise money for bowel cancer research in memory of her mother. She had always been fearless as a kid and was excited at the thought of jumping out of a plane. As they got in the tiny plane and one by one were shuffled towards the open door, she was petrified. Time seemed to slow down. There was a moment of calmness before a last-minute panic, but the second she tipped forward, all of her anxiety washed away. She felt utter freedom. They fell freely for a few seconds before a sharp jolt snapped them out of the air and the parachute adrenaline rush kicked in, and immediately she wanted to go back up and do it again. She thought she could happily do this every day, but at 17, with not much disposable income, it was unrealistic to expect she would ever jump again. 4 years later, she decided to join the army after a presentation which made her feel an adrenaline rush like she had when she first heard about skydiving. After being in the army for a while and travelling to places like Kosovo, Victoria needed a break from it all and started parachuting. She knew there was no going back for her. She was itching to learn more and become a competent skydiver. She would spend every spare weekend she had at the parachute centre. Soon, almost all of her friends and social life revolved around it. Victoria met a man named Liam who was a troop commander and a jumper and would spend the weekends jumping alongside her. He proposed a year after they met. They ended up tying the knot in a small ceremony at her home church in 2004. Around this time, Liam said he wanted to become an ammunition technical officer, which meant being away for 18 months and only coming home on weekends. He told her they would get through it. For a while they were happy, and 6 months later bought a house and tried their best to maintain a normal marriage, but they began to grow distant. Victoria was still parachuting on the weekends, which added additional stress to the precious time they had together. Liam started to act differently. He would say he couldn't make it back on certain weekends. She didn't want to suspect he was up to anything, but he came up with as many excuses as he could think of over the next few weeks, and the number of weekends he didn't come home increased. She would have a quick look at his phone on the rare occasion he left it unattended. She noticed a woman named Lucy texting him something odd. "Thinking of the pancakes we made together," said one. "I miss looking at the stars with you," said another. She noted how intimate it sounded. He had always been adamant he would never cheat and said it must just be the stress. They waded their way to the rough patch for a few months until things finally started to improve. They began to have fun together again and considered starting a family. Victoria decided to start working as a physio for the Ministry of Defence so she could follow Liam around if he needed to move for work. It made her sad to leave the military, but she wanted the freedom to make life choices for herself. One afternoon, she answered the landline and the person hung up on her. It rang several more times throughout the day, and each time it was hung up. Eventually, a woman responded. She said she was sorry to disturb her, but she wanted to tell her what an amazing husband she had, that she was on a course with him, and said Victoria was really lucky to have him, that he really loves her, and she just thought it would be nice for her to know that. Alarm bells started ringing. She asked her name, and she said, "Lucy." The same woman that had been texting him. Victoria snapped, called her a bitch and laid into her. Liam heard the commotion and sprinted upstairs to grab the phone from her. She was distraught. She couldn't believe he had done this to her, but she didn't want to give up on the marriage, and they moved to Colchester, where she got a job as a physio. In 2008, Liam was posted to Afghanistan. It was stressful and traumatizing to think about him being there. He was there for several months at a time. She still also had the fear that he would cheat on her again. When Liam got back, he started being secretive about his phone again. She saw a message notification from a woman named Fiona. One evening, Victoria bumped into Mel, a woman she knew from the military. She told her how she had seen Liam in London the other day. She said she was out with Emma and they all went for drinks. He had never told her he had bumped into Mel, much less had drinks with her, and now she knew who Emma was. She wanted to confront him, but he was going back to Afghanistan soon and she didn't want to distract him and put him on any extra strain on him when he would be in such a dangerous situation. Instead, while he was away and the nerves were eating at her, she decided to transfer to Lark Hill on her own. It was very sad and she still feels guilty about it to this day. She threw herself into parachute training. In 2009, she finally achieved her goal of becoming a qualified accelerated freefall instructor. She bought a house and continued to work 7 days a week. Her life felt very busy, but also empty. In winter 2009, she met a man named Emil Silliers. So I just want to say, I have heard this man's name be pronounced several different ways. I've heard it saying Emil, Emile, different ways. Emil is how I've always pronounced this name. I've never found anywhere that specifically says this is the correct way. I've tried to research how he pronounced it. Different, you know, news broadcasts, clips that I've seen online, and everyone just seems to pronounce it their own way. So I'm going to say Emil. If that is wrong, I do apologize. Someone please let me know if you know, because I am kind of dying to know how he actually pronounces it. So anyways, Emil walked into her treatment room one day. He was a unit physical training instructor in the Royal Artillery who had injured his knee badly on a skiing trip, resulting in quite extensive reconstructive surgery. It would be a long time before he would be able to walk properly or do anything physical. He said he needed to get better because he was joining the physical training corps. Initially, there wasn't much attraction there, but they became good friends. Over time, he grew on her and there was a spark between them. She saw the way he cared about his career and admired him for it. Everything he did, he wanted to do well, especially sports. He knew where he wanted to go in life and made it happen. He said he had two children who were his entire world. He said he was still married on paper, but was separated. At first, Victoria was unsure, but shortly after, they began dating. He took her climbing and to an assault course on their first date. He had energy and enthusiasm for new experiences. He loved outdoor sports and activities, and it was great to have someone in her life who would share these interests with her. They just seemed to click. The beginning of their relationship was a whirlwind. Emil was no one she had ever met before, and he was utterly charming. There's that word again. They were inseparable, and she wanted to know everything about him. He said he was originally from Cape Town, South Africa, and had come to the UK as an adult. He ended up staying because he met a woman named Carly, and she had gotten pregnant only 4 months into their relationship. He didn't want to stay with her, but also didn't want to go back to South Africa when he had a child in a different country. Victoria liked the fact that he had stuck by his child. They had a registry office wedding so that he could continue to live there. He said it was just one of those things. That he never really loved Carly and only married her because it made it easier for him to see his child and he wanted to do the right thing. It was apparent there was no love lost between him and his ex-wife, and he continued to speak badly of her. Guys, just note, if you meet a man and he continually speaks poorly of his ex, and I'm not talking like, oh, she cheated on me or, you know, whatever it is. Like, things like constantly like they're never the bad guy, look at it as a major red flag. He said Carly stopped working when she got pregnant and it got to the point where his daughter was about 4. He suggested she go back to work, but she instead decided to have another baby. He felt duty bound to give his child a sibling. Victoria felt slightly uncomfortable hearing him speak so badly of her as he continued by calling her lazy and work shy, but she dismissed it. And this is what I mean, things like that, like, you can say, you know, okay, the reason we split up was she didn't want to go back to work and, you know, was continually lying about it. I didn't accept that, whatever. But like, if you're using words like lazy, work shy, like speaking badly about her, like that, about your ex like that, I just feel like it's very rare. If I guess something my ex used to do. For me, it's kind of firstly them not wanting to come across as the bad guy. It's kind of that, oh, poor me, and it's another way to suck you in and be on their side. And also just, I think it's kind of a way to just, you know, speak about women in general. I feel like their whole thing is that they just want to put down women all the time. So anyways, Victoria and Emil's relationship moved rapidly and he was really intense right from the get-go, wanting to spend every second with her. Again, we all know, major red flag. While it felt a bit too soon, she couldn't help but enjoy the attention being showered upon her. They worked in the same building and he would make excuses to pop in and see her, bringing her coffee. I actually spoke about this recently with a friend of mine just a couple of days ago. And he was talking about how, like, he had an ex that used to continually come into his work and, like, start beef with his co-workers that she was, like, suspicious of, jealous of, and whatever. And, you know, it brought back a lot of memories of, like, when I was still with my abuser and he would, you know, show up at my job and be like, oh, you got this piece of mail that looked really important. I just wanted to make sure you got it. Or, you know, one time he called the store, like the actual store, to, and I was like, this was before I was in a managerial position and I was just working on the register, like, you know, in the main shop floor, was busy. The phone rings, it's my manager saying, oh, you have a call online, whatever. And I'm like, what? And I'm freaking out thinking, oh my God, is, like, you know, is it my mom? Is somebody dead in Ireland? Like, what's happening? And, you know, I'm panicking. And then it was just him calling to say, oh, you, I got an email that, like, your immigration paperwork has been approved or, like, whatever it was. And I was like, okay, like, you could have texted me that. Like, you know, I have a phone. Like, it was just hugely inappropriate. And it's such a way of, like, making me look bad at my job and also just checking up on me and making sure that I was at work, which is something that he used to do all the time. So yeah, it's just not, I feel like your relationships and your work life should not combine in any way. Like, there's no reason for your partner to come to your job or to call your job like that. Like, we all have phones now, personal phones, text, you know, whatever, about like, okay, I'm going to drop you off to work, or I'm going to like meet you outside your job and, you know, pick you up outside of work, whatever it is. But like, it's just, again, like another way to control you. Emil told Victoria he loved her after only a few weeks of dating. She admitted she loved him too, and after a few months of seeing each other, he moved in with her. One day he said he was going to ask Carly if he could bring the kids around to meet Victoria. It bothered her slightly that he hadn't asked if she was okay with meeting them so soon. It was a big step, but she decided against voicing her concerns. Carly said she wanted to meet Victoria before this happened. Perfectly understandable. They ended up getting along well when they met, but as Carly was leaving, she paused and said, "I assume you know about the other children." Victoria was confused. What children? It turned out that Emil had had a couple of children with a woman back in South Africa, but that her and the kids lived in the UK now. Victoria was floored by the revelation. It was hard to believe he had been deliberately keeping this from her, but she still wanted to believe he had his reasons. When she confronted him, he said he didn't know how to mention it. He pleaded with her and said how sorry he was. He didn't want to lose her. He said he didn't have anything to do with them, which is why he never mentioned them before. He said the mother made the decision to take them from him. She decided to believe him. Again, this is also like, major, if I feel like you would do whatever it was in your power to be around your kids, see your kids. Also, like the fact that you're gonna, oh, I'm gonna tell you about these kids, but not about these other kids that I have. I don't know if any of you guys watch Vanderpump Rules. You guys all know that I'm a big reality TV person, and if you know Brock and Sheena, so Brock is an Australian guy. And he has a, I don't know if they were married or not, actually, his ex, I can't remember that, but he has like at least two kids, I think, with her in Australia, does not see them, does not have contact with them. He was, I know there was an incident where he shoved his ex, pushed her, hit her, something like that, and it all stemmed from that fact. But how he is on the show, and he has like he's married now to Sheena and he has a kid with her, it's like he just has this one child and has nothing to do with the other kid. It's just, the whole situation to me is so icky. If you're a fan of the show, you know about this, but I just feel like it's major red flag situation. Like, if you are seeing someone and they're not allowed to see their kids, like, that's like, that has to be something really bad, that you cannot see your kids anymore, and also that they're in a different country. It's just I don't even know. So after that conversation, they never really mentioned those kids again. Again, that's major, like, what? The idea that he could so easily forget about them felt alien to Victoria. She was quite upfront from the start about wanting to have kids with him, and he agreed and said he would love to have kids with her. She was so head over heels for him that she didn't take a step back and think about the bigger picture. She was excited about their future together. He was cooking meals for her every night, buying her favorite wine. She was too happy to worry about issues from his past. She felt he was a good man who had made mistakes that were his ex's fault as much as his own. She had to take him at face value. A month or so after he moved in, he started to tell her about his financial situation. She knew he had debts, which he blamed mainly on his ex-wife, because of course, on his ex-wife refusing to work and spending money at home all day from their joint account. This all felt like another bombshell to Victoria. But when she asked how much he owed, he said it was only £2,000. She was relieved and told him she would clear it for him and he could pay her back later. She immediately saw the relief on his face. She had taught him how to pack parachutes, and he would come along with her to the centre to pack everyone's parachutes for money, and very soon he had had her paid back. They then made the decision to get a joint account. It made sense for household expenses. Everything seemed to be falling into place. When I hear about joint accounts, I don't care if you're married, like, it just, I get major like trauma flashbacks from that. I'm just like, even when it's just stuff like household expenses, I'm just like, no, I can't. I just like, I hate it. I hate the phrase. I hate everything to do with it. It just reminds me of like, oh God, I wish I could rewind the clock sometimes and change so many things when I think about all the money that was taken from me. Oh my God, it makes me want to vomit. Anyways, she was keen to meet his family and friends, and so in January 2011, just over a year since they met, they flew to South Africa for 3 weeks to stay with his parents. She was welcomed with open arms, his parents were warm and friendly and did everything to make their stay enjoyable and comfortable. His mother said he had never spoken about anyone the way he spoke about her. She was ecstatic. During the trip, Emile proposed to her. She was finally getting her happily ever after. A few months before their wedding, she found out she was pregnant. They were very happy with the news. A few weeks later, Emile was due to play a cricket match in London, and they decided to make a trip of it. When the day of the trip rolled around, Victoria noticed she was bleeding. Something wasn't right, and she was panicking. They told her at the hospital that unfortunately she had had a miscarriage. They said she could stay in hospital and have a removal or let nature take its course. She chose the latter. Emile drove her home, and while he had been upset by the news, his mind seemed to be on the match. He said he didn't know whether they should go or not and asked her would she be up for it. She didn't know what to say. The last thing she wanted to do was go to London. The idea of socialising felt like hell. She asked him if he wanted to go. He said they had already booked their accommodation. She said the baby was already gone, hoping he would interject, but he instead smiled and said maybe they should go. She felt like she could cry, but had no choice but to go along with him. The drive to London was slow and the pain had become worse. He kept saying she'd be okay once they got to the hotel, but as soon as they got to the building, they realised they hadn't been put up in a hotel at all. Instead, they were led to the team's room. There were no beds. The staff member pointed out sleeping bags and roll mats piled in the corner. The only bathroom was a communal one, several flights of stairs below. She told Emile she didn't want to be here. He protested that they were already here and he couldn't just leave the team. She was already losing a lot of blood and was humiliated at the thought of anyone noticing. He then offered her the car keys. All she wanted was for him to tell the team he was leaving and that his fiancée was having a miscarriage. She was experiencing what felt like the worst period pains, so she took the keys and drove back home. She kept thinking of the fact that he was going on a night out in London instead of taking care of her. It felt completely out of character, but she blamed herself as she had told him to go. He had called a friend to come and stay with her, but the only person she wanted there was him. It was a gut-wrenching disappointment that he didn't seem to understand the pain of losing your baby. Like, can you just imagine that? First of all, it's like the first time you get pregnant, you're super excited about it. You're madly in love. And you have this horrendous thing happen to you. Like, I can't even imagine what it's like to have a miscarriage. I can only assume it's extremely traumatizing mentally and physically. The pain of it, you're experiencing like your body rejecting and ejecting this thing that you thought was going to be the best thing to ever happen to you. So that your hormones are going to be all over the place, and then you're also mentally dealing with the fact that like, oh, I was so happy to be pregnant and now I'm not. Like, I can't even imagine it. And then to have your partner who is just like, okay, well, let's still drive down to London for a few hours because I've got this match, and then we're going to stay over in a hotel that doesn't have beds, sharing a room, sharing a bathroom, while you're bleeding, you have horrendous cramps, and expect that that's okay. Like, oh my God, my heart really just goes out to her when I hear this story. It's just so horrific, and it's so sad. And you know, this is the first time she's experienced him kind of like not caring and like closing himself off to her and just kind of like sending her off to drive herself. Oh, I just think it's so heartbreaking. And I really just, my heart goes out to her during this. Victoria decided not to take any time off of work and instead kept busy. Emil seemed to resent that and wanted her at home with him. 6 weeks later, on the day they were due to fly to South Africa for their wedding, she found out she was pregnant again. Emil was so excited. On her wedding day, she couldn't imagine life being more perfect. They went to Paris for their honeymoon. They had a great time, but while lining up outside a restaurant one day, she felt a rushing sensation like she was going to wet herself. She was losing another baby. They were due home the next day, so decided to wait until then to see a doctor. The doctor said there were big black areas on the scan, which meant a collection of blood forming. They weren't sure if the blood would be absorbed or come out, but for now, the baby looked absolutely fine, so there was still hope. It ended up being a painfully difficult pregnancy, with uncontrollable bleeding every few weeks. It was exhausting and emotionally draining. Reaching the 28-week mark was a huge weight off Victoria's shoulders. Emil wanted to go away with some friends one weekend, knowing she was anxious at being left alone in case something went wrong. He bought her a teddy with a heartbeat and said if she felt anxious or got scared to listen to the heartbeat and imagine it was their baby inside her. She had a regular scan booked for the day she finished work for maternity leave in April 2012, but they got the news that the baby had stopped growing. The baby had to be born today. Later that day, they had a baby girl and they called her April. Emil was a great father to April, yet their financial troubles were simmering in the background. Victoria had noticed small amounts of money being withdrawn every now and again from their joint account. She always assumed he would put it back in again. One day, she received a warning letter from the retail store Next, claiming she hadn't paid for her latest order, but she hadn't ordered anything from them for months. She scrolled through the list of items and didn't recognise a single product. She asked Emil if he had been purchasing items on her account. He quickly snapped at her and his tone took her by complete surprise. He couldn't believe she was accusing him. He said someone must have hacked into her account. She began feeling guilty for doubting him. She'd never even seen him wear any of the products purchased. She said she'd never mention it and she wished she'd never mentioned it and he gave her the cold shoulder until she apologised. She cancelled the account, but despite telling Next what happened, she was still liable for the money owed. She settled and closed the account. Little money incidents started to crop up more and more. Every few months, the phone would be cut off for an unpaid bill and she'd realise their joint account was empty. Emil always had an excuse ready for the unpaid bills. She even found paperwork that he'd taken out an overdraft in her name and eventually also a loan. He would give excuses like there being a mix-up at work and he wasn't paid on time or they forgot to do his wages completely that month. But any hint that she didn't believe him sent him flying off the handle. He'd shout, "You don't trust me." As much as she wanted to shout back, it just wasn't worth it. She had learned that if she challenged him, he would sulk for days and barely speak to her, making things extremely uncomfortable. She couldn't live like that, and so she would always be the one to crack and make an effort to bring him around. And that is a perfect, perfect, perfect example of gaslighting. Every so often, she would send him money to pay off any overdrafts he had opened. When she would check the accounts a few days later, however, it would still be outstanding. The money always disappeared no matter what she did, but he would never listen when she would try and talk about it with him. She suspected he was spending money on his hobbies. He had been into photography for a while and was now into climbing and cricket. When she would spot a new piece of equipment, he'd tell her he bought it secondhand or had borrowed it from a friend. He kept things in his car or at work, so it was hard for her to keep track of everything. She wanted to trust the man she was married to. He suggested one day that they should move house. The one she had bought a few years ago was old and not safe for children. She wondered if they could even afford to buy it. He said he would ring the bank and make an appointment. At the meeting, it became apparent that his money troubles were bad. They couldn't offer them a mortgage at the bank with their rating. Amongst the loans and unpaid bills, which were all in Victoria's name, her credit rating had taken a nosedive. She was so embarrassed. She had always been careful with her savings, but Emil was draining them. He suggested on the way home that they use her inheritance. Her grandmother had died recently and left her and her brother some money. She didn't even think that money would cover a new house. She didn't think moving was an option for them currently. Then Emil suggested asking her brother Christopher to help them out. She knew he wasn't going to let this go. She said she couldn't ask her brother for that kind of money. Emil insisted it was to borrow only. This reminds me so much of my situation. I'm sure I've probably talked about this in the earlier episodes of the podcast when I was telling my own story, but like my ex was obsessed with money. Like money was his number one thing on his brain all the fucking time. But he was terrible with it. And, you know, he found out that my brother had inherited some money. It wasn't really inheritance, it was like something else, but I won't get into the details. It's not really my story to tell, but you know, he contacted him to say that, oh, we're really broke and like we didn't know what to do, and all this like big sob story, all without me knowing. And then, you know, he ended up offering a loan, which he took and never paid back. And like he used to spend it on, like, I remember him going to like a football match or something and like got really expensive tickets. He bought merch, he bought like, you know, alcohol and food and all that on the day out, and that's all it was spent on. And then, you know, it was like months later, this is like right before I was about to leave him, and we were having to like move apartment, I think this is what it was for anyway, and like pay a deposit. And he knew we weren't going to get the deposit back in our apartment because I didn't know at that point that he owed them like 3 months rent. So he was like desperate again for money, and he had texted me one morning. He was like, you have to ask your family for money, you're going to have to get a loan from them. Like he was trying to get even more money out of them, knowing that he had already taken a bunch of money and not paid it back. Like, it's just so gross. And I believe personally, after everything I've gone through, even if you're married, like, I mean, you can totally disagree with me. I've not been in a marriage, I've not had kids, and it's, you know, I don't believe that just because you're married you have to like merge your finances, or like, you know, completely anyways, at least. So, and I think also I would warn people, even if the person that you're getting into a relationship or getting married to is not an abuser, if always find out what their financial situation is, because that's going to be on you at some point too. Because if you're going to be sharing an apartment, sharing a house, having kids together, getting married, like this is going to become your responsibility also. So I just think that's something that you really need to be aware of going into any type of relationship like this. And you know, that's just my two cents on it. So anyway, Victoria's brother Christopher happily agreed to help them, but he and her dad both agreed the condition was the deed had to be in Victoria's name only, and they had to sign a prenuptial agreement. Smart men. Yes, love this. They quickly found a perfect house, but Victoria worried about making the payments to her brother each month. She suggested they apply for planning permission for their current house instead, but Emil was adamant they move. He said that he would pay the majority of the money back each month so she wouldn't have to worry. She was surprised by the suggestion. She thought to herself that he would never pay back the money and worried about causing a rift with her brother. She suggested he transfer it to her account and she would pay Christopher. That way, she thought, if he doesn't come through, at least Christopher would never know. For the first few months, the arrangement worked well until she started to get missed transfers. He again blamed a mix-up with his wages. She said he should complain about that it wasn't acceptable. She had to just take his word for it. But bit by bit, all of the bills fell to her. Another issue was that she was missing the income from the parachute center. Becoming a mother had changed her attitude to the sport, and it felt more like a job than a fun hobby. She had lost the spark for it and was more aware of the dangers of it and worried about what an injury would mean for her job as a mother. She decided to cut down on her hours. Emil was over the moon and suggested they try for another baby. What is it with this man and wanting to have more and more kids? After a year of trying, Victoria decided to get tested. The doctor told her he also needed a sperm sample from Emil, who was with a different medical center. He told her they could have it sent over. She asked one evening if Emil had gone to the doctor for the sample, and he said he had and that it was all fine. She said she needed the results to show her own doctor. He said he didn't have anything like that. She suspected that he hadn't actually been tested at all, but couldn't face an argument with him. She had an urge to take a pregnancy test and was surprised when it was positive. While Emil seemed happy, he lacked the excitement he had had when she fell pregnant with April. He went back to his lunch and didn't even get up to hug her. Shortly afterward, things began to change noticeably. A friend's 16-year-old daughter had done some babysitting for them, and one day she called him out of the blue. She said she felt really awkward saying this. Okay, sorry, I feel like I read that weird, or I worded it weird. It's the mother of the 16-year-old, so this is Victoria's friend. So she said she felt really awkward saying this, but she thought Emil had been asking her daughter inappropriate questions and sending her a lot of messages. She sent her screenshots and she was stunned. Things like, "Do you have a boyfriend? You look really nice this evening." Her stomach plummeted and her body shook. She apologized and said she would speak to him. But when she confronted him, he said it wasn't true. His phone must have been cloned, he claimed. It had nothing to do with him. She snapped at him, asking how his phone could be cloned. Then he suggested his Apple account must have been hacked. How could she think that of him? "The messages are right there," she said as she showed him the screenshots. He became aggressive and asked how she couldn't believe him. Excuse me. Did she really think so little of him? She said she wanted to believe him. It was entirely out of character for him. It must have been a mistake. He then stormed out of the house. So he has again somehow managed to turn inappropriate text to a 16-year-old around on her again. He can't have done this, Victoria thought. She should have trusted him. The next morning, she was about to leave the house with April when she noticed Emil had taken her car. As she got in, she had an urge to check the glove compartment and saw the empty sample pot and paperwork from the doctor's surgery. He had lied to her, but she never broached the topic with him as she was pregnant and felt it wasn't worth it. A few days later, some emails from his account popped up on their shared computer. She glanced at the subject line, not intending to open them, but couldn't help it when she saw he was receiving emails from a sex club. He seemed to be taken aback when she confronted him. He then said he used to go there with his ex-wife and still sometimes received emails from them. But she knew he had new email accounts and new phone numbers all these years later. She tried to dismiss it, but a few weeks later, more messages appeared. "I had a great time tonight. It was just as well there was a security camera in the car park, otherwise who knows what would have happened." She was furious and confronted him. He again said his account was hacked. She said she wasn't stupid and knew he hadn't been hacked. In a condescending tone, he said, "Don't put your own issues onto me. Just because your ex-husband cheated on you doesn't mean you can be paranoid with me." She wondered why he was being like this with her. He often stayed home and made dinner for them. He rarely went out or showed much interest in going out. She couldn't even imagine him in a sex club. Then she found a receipt from Nando's in his pocket for two meals. The glass of wine and salad felt distinctly female to her. He insisted it wasn't his. She was determined to catch him out in his lies. Her chance came one day when April had thrown up on the carpet after dinner. Emil couldn't clean it up and suggested he go out to buy some proper carpet cleaner. When he came home, she got the receipt from the bag to find the same card had been used for both the store and for Nando's dinner. "Wow," he said, "I think you're losing it." She protested, but he wouldn't let her speak. "This is all because of your insecurities with your ex-husband, and now you're checking my receipts." It did sound ludicrous, and even she began to doubt herself. She apologized. He said she was crazy. It was as though her loving, doting husband had been replaced by someone else. And again, another perfect example of gaslighting. Victoria ended up at every scan for the baby alone. He would say he was busy and couldn't just drop work. She was too tired to argue back. She was still working full time, juggling childcare for April and preparing for the new baby's arrival with no help from Emil. Plus, she had a constant fear of losing another baby. She couldn't relax. Their money problems were also increasing. Small amounts still periodically being withdrawn from her savings. The amounts were even increasing, as was the frequency. Again, when she voiced it, he had his excuses ready. There was no way for her to prove he was lying. She had many sleepless nights worrying about how they were going to manage. She was paying for everything, despite him earning more than her. He suggested her card had been cloned or stolen. She said she should get the card cancelled in that case to see his reaction, but he said it was for the best. They said they would send her a replacement, but 2 weeks later she still had not received it. She said it was weird as money was still going out. He then suggested the post had been intercepted. Someone must have taken the card, or maybe you've taken it, she saw. One afternoon, she was searching through his paperwork and found her missing credit card stashed away in his file of fax. She was angry, but felt there was no point confronting him as he would have his excuses ready. She decided she needed to be more careful and changed her passwords and closed her online banking account so that he wouldn't be able to go into the bank and get it out. But he still found a way to siphon off their savings. At one point, his mother was in hospital and had to settle her bill before she could leave. Emil came to Victoria looking sheepish, saying he was going to sell some stuff so he could give his dad a grand to help out. It seemed wrong to Victoria, and so she said she would send his dad the money. He told her his dad would be too proud to take it from her, and it would be best if it came from him. Knowing his dad, it made sense to Victoria. It was only later she found out that just half of the money had made it to his father. She was desperately trying to protect herself in April from Emil's impulsive and irresponsible behaviour, but even that didn't feel right. On top of his financial behaviour, he was also finding reasons to spend less time at home. He cleared off whenever he could, volunteering for work over the weekends or signing up to compete with the skydiving team. He was on a trip with the British Skydiving Nationals when she saw pictures of him on Facebook cozying up to various women. She felt foolish. The photos weren't terrible, but seeing him clearly drunk with his arms draped over another woman felt inappropriate. She hadn't heard from him while he'd been away. When the phone rang the next morning, it was the first she had heard from him in days. He said he needed her to pick him up as his car had been impounded. He said it wasn't insured, but it was a mistake. He hadn't paid the insurance on it, but he insisted, as usual, that it wasn't his fault, that the insurers had messed up, but the car couldn't be released until he had paid for it. She knew that she would be the one to pay for it, and when she did, she didn't even get a thank you from him. They went to their friend's party one night and her friend saw someone's phone screen light up and loudly exclaimed that someone has had a Tinder message. Emil looked over and said it was his phone. Victoria was so embarrassed. She felt sick. She downloaded the app when they got home, and when he caught what she was doing, he immediately lost his temper. You don't trust me. You're trying to catch me out, she thought. It seemed a guilty response to her. She asked why he even had a Tinder account. He said his friends put him on there for a laugh. He again accused her of having issues. Did he really have such little respect for her that he could treat her like this? Answer being yes. That October, he announced he was going away for a skiing trip with work. She said she would like to go, and he said maybe for a few days. But she said she needed to stay home and take care of April, turning down what she knew was an empty gesture. She knew he wouldn't want her there. She wanted him to choose his family over a skiing trip, but a few days later he left. She was petrified again of miscarrying and was constantly bursting into tears over the tiniest thing. Even over a text, Emil was distant. Occasionally he would phone to speak with April, but never wanted to talk to Victoria. The only time he contacted her was when he wanted to sext. He had no interest in how she was coping. She just needed someone to hug her, to tell her that they loved her. During one of her hospital visits, she suddenly broke down in front of the midwife. She asked if something was wrong at home. She said how her husband was away and it was all too much. She wished she could tell her what was really going on. On one of Emil's calls, he asked her bluntly what she wanted for Christmas, that he may as well get his Christmas presents while he was in Australia. Or Austria. She asked for some slippers or a box of chocolates. He said he didn't have any money. She said she could give him some money. He said it was fine. She knew slippers weren't expensive, but at least he was thinking of her, she thought. She decided to take it as a positive sign. When you're in this situation, like, you really just take the scraps that these guys will give you. She also decided in this time that to protect the kids from his terrible finances, she would change her will. She had her estate divided between the kids. She knew Emil would be covered for housing and support through his job. He didn't get home until 2 days before Christmas. She was left to do all of the preparation by herself. He was a different person. He was now completely dismissive of her. He was always glued to his phone and ignored any attempt she made at conversation. He was also lying unnecessarily about everything. She asked when he had started smoking, as she could smell the cigarettes on his clothes. He said he wasn't smoking. A few days later, however, she found a packet of cigarettes in his pocket. They had a few weeks off together during the Christmas break, and she decided to make the most of it by not arguing with him. She felt quite positive as they drove to her stepsister's for Christmas Day, but he wasn't even present with her family around. She suggested they go for a walk, but he just shook his head, not even looking up from his phone. She kept stealing glances at the phone and seeing the name Stephanie on the screen. She realized she didn't know anything about her husband's life anymore. They went to open their presents together with April on Christmas morning, and as she handed Emil his stocking, his face fell. He said he hadn't gotten her anything, that he had ordered something, but it never came, and he didn't have much money. She knew the real reason was that he didn't care enough to buy her anything, but she stayed quiet about it. Her disappointment turned into embarrassment as the morning wore on, and she sat empty-handed watching everyone else open their gifts. She thought, I mean so little to him that I didn't even warrant a £5 box of chocolates. He didn't get her so much as a card. She helped April with her gifts, trying to distract herself from the fact that she was the only one in the room with nothing to open. No one else seemed to notice. It was one of the worst days of her life. Then Emil stunned her with an announcement. He was going away again for a few weeks and would be gone for New Year's. He said he had to run a course over in Germany. She knew that even the army reserves didn't work over the holiday season. When he left, she got a notification from the bank saying transactions on her credit card had bounced back due to insufficient funding. Emil had tried to purchase flights and currency with her card. When she confronted him, he said as it was last minute, he had to pay the tickets and then work would pay him back. She realised then that her husband didn't love her and she was trapped. Once he had left for his trip, Victoria didn't hear anything from Emil for the first couple of days. She hoped he was all right. Eventually, she heard from him and he said the service was really bad and there was no Wi-Fi. She knew he was lying as she had previously spoken to a friend who had been posted in the same location and she told her the whole camp was wired up to the internet. She spent New Year's at her friend's place but felt extremely lonely. She stayed up waiting to get a New Year's message from Emil but it never came. She didn't hear from him until the following afternoon with a bland message saying Happy New Year, nothing else. She ignored the message and an hour later he responded, Oh, be like that then. She knew he was up to something over there. It had never been easy to get a chance to have a heart-to-heart with her friends about everything because Emil was always really watchful. If friends came to see her, he would sit with them even if he wasn't taking part in the conversation. One of her friends joked, Can't you get rid of your husband? How can we have a good gossip with the man in the room? She also worried if she told them about his behaviour that they would tell her to leave him and she wasn't strong enough to make that step. She realised she had no choice but to keep it to herself and the thought made her upset. She spent New Year's Day in tears, unable to deny the truth anymore. I think my husband is cheating on me. After putting April to bed, she burst into tears, thinking how Emil probably wouldn't even care if she miscarried. Suddenly, she felt a tiny pair of arms around her legs. It was April. Don't worry, Mummy. I'll look after you and the baby. Daddy will come home soon. Victoria hugged her, saying not to worry, that they were going to be fine. She felt she had nothing left to lose and typed a message to Emil. I have loved you more each year. It feels like you keep trying to push me away until I jump ship, but I can't. I love you too much. It just feels now that you will be happier without me. She then put her phone aside, knowing not to expect a reply. By the time Emil returned, she had barely talked to anyone but 2-year-old April for 2 weeks. They had been the loneliest weeks of her life, but even with him home, she may as well have been on her own. He avoided her altogether, choosing to spend time in any room she wasn't in. They were sitting in silence one evening watching TV when her phone pinged with an email from Emil. She wondered why he would email her when she was in the same room. She opened the message. Talking to you over email is a lot easier because you get too emotional when I talk to you face to face. I'm not sure how I feel about the marriage. I'm not sure I want to be married to you anymore. I need some time out to think. I'll still be there for you and the baby though. She said, This is ridiculous. We can't just keep sending emails to each other. We need to talk about this. She asked him if there was someone else. He said there wasn't. He said he had been given a room at the base and was going to stay there while he was working. He said he would stick by her for the first few months of the baby being born, but then they should have a rethink about the relationship. His words cut her like a knife. So he went away, reappearing every now and again on the weekends. It felt cruel. He then said he was going on another trip, a military driving trip. She said they would have a newborn by then, but he responded that no, the baby would be a few weeks old by then. On their shared laptop, she found emails he had sent to his instructor asking what the accommodation arrangements were because he wanted to bring his girlfriend. She checked the internet history and discovered searches for sex and fetish clubs in the local area and in areas where he had visited. She felt sick. He had driven her to a point where she didn't even recognize herself anymore. The woman she used to be would have stuck up for herself and gotten out of such a toxic situation. The woman she was now had zero confidence that she would look after both herself and her children. His constant lying made her feel weak and worthless. What was wrong with her that two husbands had thought so little of her that they would cheat on her? But she felt she couldn't end the marriage as she had a baby on the way and needed help. A few days after Valentine's, she felt the beginning of labour pain. She texted her dad, who said he was on the way over. She texted Emil and he told her he would come straight home after work. It was only noon, so she knew she would have to wait out his return. When he got home, she still wasn't ready for the hospital, and she knew he was probably dying for sleep, so she told him to go to bed. He'd been showing no interest anyway, his head locked on his phone. Her dad frowned at him. At 1 a.m, she went upstairs to wake Emil, knowing she couldn't wait any longer. On getting to the hospital, labour slowed and they told her the baby was stuck. Emil sat back in the chair by the bed while she screamed in agony. A few times he held her hand, but he always had his phone in the other. Finally, it was over and she had a beautiful baby boy named Ben. She looked over at Emil, who didn't seem interested. He held the baby, but still hadn't spoken to Victoria. She asked him if he loved her. He didn't respond. His blank expression focused on the baby. She was devastated. She just wanted to be hugged and to feel loved. The doctor informed them that because of the length of the labour, they would have to stay under observation for 12 hours and would be allowed home at 8 o'clock that night. Emil protested that that was a bit late, that they had a 2-year-old at home. Victoria knew it was because he didn't want her home yet. The doctor suggested she stay for the night. She agreed, thinking she would do Emil a favour when she clearly wasn't wanted. He agreed it was probably the best. Later that afternoon, he called her and said he would pick her up tonight after all. She was shocked. It was the first positive thing he had said to her in a long time, and she was excited. April had stayed up late to meet her brother, and her parents took pictures of them together. Maybe things were looking up. The next few days were great with her parents around, and Emil seemed in better form also. But as soon as they left, he went back to being distant again. One day soon after the birth of Ben, Emil announced he was taking Victoria's car for the day. It irritated her as there was nothing wrong with his car, he just preferred to use hers. The car would come back smelling of cigarettes with ashes piled up in the cup holders. He still denied smoking at all when she confronted him. He jumped up from his seat and the expression on his face was stone cold. It was so horrifying she couldn't forget it. She knew he always overreacted and became aggressive when he was lying. One Sunday evening, when she was giving Ben his evening feed, Emil said he was going to head back to the army barracks for the night. It was already past 10 p.m. He said he wanted to avoid traffic and wouldn't be able to sleep with the baby. She assumed he would head out right away, but she heard him wandering around downstairs and wondered what he was doing. The next morning, she went to the kitchen before the kids awoke to make some tea and get April's lunch ready. She realized she could smell gas. She turned off the lever for the pipe that led to the gas oven and noticed what looked like dried blood along the pipe. She texted Emil to ask if he had altered the gas lever. Emil had cut his hand that weekend and it had bled a lot. He responded, asking her if the stove was working. She almost laughed as she typed that she wasn't about to find out or she'd blow the house up. He told her to open all the windows and doors and leave it for a while. After a while, the smell seemed to be gone, so she turned the lever back on. The reek of gas hit her all at once. She coughed as she turned the pipe off again. She called a gas man who arrived that evening. He said it looked like one of the bolts had come loose, and he tightened it and said it should now be okay. She texted Emil jokingly asking if he was trying to kill her. He quickly replied, "Why? You cannot be serious about the comment you've just made. You've been saying that a lot recently. Why would you think that?" She rolled her eyes at how defensive he was being, but couldn't stop thinking about how out of control his reactions were. How could he possibly have thought she was being serious? Emil's aggressive outbursts were becoming unbearable. He would yell at her to stop checking up on him when she confronted him once again with proof of his cheating. The mood of the house was dependent on how he was behaving that day. If he was in a good mood, their home was quite warm. On his bad days, the house remained quiet. Lying awake one night, Victoria realised she couldn't take it anymore. She sat up and threw on some clothes, making eye contact with Emil, who had woken up. She opened the front door and slammed it behind her, making sure he would hear it. She wandered aimlessly through the streets, wondering what to do. As she sought any form of escape from her life at home, she began getting up early before the kids and walking for hours through the dark streets, completely distraught, with the thoughts racing through her head as she tried to process everything. While the walks calmed her, they also made her upset, as Emil never once checked up on her. She didn't want to be at home anymore and would dread turning back to go home. I remember that feeling so well. I've spoken to you several times before about how I would be having a great day outside of the house, and then I would turn into my block and the feeling of anxiety would slowly come over me. And I always remembered that, like, putting the key in the lock and hearing the click and the turn of the lock and being like, oh, I'm home. Whereas, like, now I come into my apartment and I hear the door lock click and I'm like, oh my God, I'm home. I'm so happy. Like, everyone should feel that when they're coming into their own house. Not this, like, you should never have a feeling of dread when you're walking into your house. And if you do, whatever the situation is, that is saying a lot. Victoria still loved Emil despite everything and thought that they could still make it. He did become a bit more attentive having a newborn in the house. The small glimpses of normality gave her hope. One morning, he called her and said he had been thinking it would be a good idea for them to take a jump together. Her heart leapt. It had been so long since he had wanted to do anything with her. She said she would really like that, and he set everything up. It would be her first skydive in a year, and the thought of jumping again filled her with dread, but she knew having a meal with her would help. She had to borrow a kit, as hers had to be taken to the manufacturer for his service and would be gone for a few weeks. When she got home, Emil said he couldn't find a sitter for the kids and so she should just jump alone instead. She was disappointed but didn't want to upset him. When the day arrived, Emil seemed to be in such a good mood. They walked over to the kit store when April said she needed to use the bathroom. Emil said he would take her while she got everything sorted out. He swung her parachute over his shoulder and off he went. They seemed to be gone for ages, so Victoria went to check on them. She pushed open the door but heard April chatting away to her father, so she went back to her spot by reception. When Emil got back, he said she probably wouldn't be able to jump because of the weather. He still had the parachute over his shoulder, and Victoria said they should return it and head home. He insisted she leave it in her locker, as it would take too long to find someone to return it to. Keeping the parachute in her locker wouldn't have been something she'd normally do, but as they weren't really supposed to do that, but the weather seemed too bad for anyone to possibly need it for the rest of the day. Plus, they knew her there as she worked there, and they could call her if it was an issue. Emil suggested she just do the jump tomorrow. When they returned home and she sat next to him on the couch, he affectionately put his hand on her leg and asked what she wanted to watch. She almost jolted with shock. Things really were looking up, she thought. She thought about her perfect babies asleep upstairs and almost cried at the thought of her perfect family. On the morning of the jump, Victoria was extremely tired as Ben had been awake all night and she wanted to back out. Emil, however, was insistent she do it and suggested she go out now while the baby slept. She was sick with nerves, but also didn't want to let Emil down as he had planned it out for her and things were going so well with him recently. She went to her locker to get the parachute Emil had left there for her. While she hung around waiting to be cleared for the jump, her nerves got worse. She felt she had a sixth sense not to do it. Something inside her was screaming no. She texted Emil and said the weather didn't seem to be clearing and she wanted to return home. He kept encouraging her and even told her Google had said the weather would be clearing. He seemed to really care about her doing the jump. She couldn't give up now. Eventually, they were told they would be doing a low-level lift. She was relieved. A low-level jump meant they would only be flying up to the cloud base, reaching 5,000 feet at the most. She thought to herself that she could do it as it was an easy jump. However, as soon as she sat on the plane, she felt the regret. She couldn't figure out why. She just wanted to be at home with her kids. She even started to get teary-eyed. She was shaking and felt like throwing up, a feeling of dread in the pit of her stomach. She thought about the kids waiting for her at home and resolved that this would be her final jump. She tried to stay focused and listen to the pilot. He said, "The clouds are lower than we expected and the jump master has made the decision that only a few people can exit with each pass." Victoria groaned at the news, realizing she would be last as she was sat at the back. Once she was alone, she felt herself kick into gear and let the fear be pushed to the back of her mind. This part felt like second nature to her. She was given the signal to go and held her breath as she leapt into the sky. A rush of cold air hit her face. She finally felt a sense of calm. She navigated her way through the air easily. She knew what she was doing. She reached for the toggle at the base of the rig strapped to her back and pulled it outwards to deploy the parachute. The canopy billowed out above her, but instead of slowing her down, she felt an uneven jolt. She looked up. The lines attached to the parachute were badly twisted. She was in shock for a split second, but quickly focused, knowing she had seen this happen before. It was annoying, but she knew she could get out of it. She kicked through the air, unravelling the twists as she went. The line was untangling, but it became clear something else wasn't right as she looked up and saw the parachute wasn't cooperating. None of her years of training could have prepared her for what was happening. She couldn't fix it. She knew she had to deploy the reserve. She had to act fast, cutting away her parachute as she dropped further through the sky. She held her breath to prepare for what she knew would be an aggressive jolt from the fast-acting backup. She tugged the toggle line to open it. It was designed to open instantly in a snap motion that would jerk you upwards. I'm sure we've all seen clips of people parachuting and seen that like jerking motion once they open the toggle. She waited for the tug, but she felt nothing. She looked up in horror. The reserve had only partially inflated. The malfunction caused the parachute to spin out of control. She began to panic. The violent spins were knocking her sideways until she was almost upside down. She fought against the elements, tugging desperately on the risers above her head. She kicked her legs in the opposite direction, struggling against the wind. Once she got a momentum going, the line started to untangle, but the relief was only short-lived as she began to spin even more violently. She tried everything she could to take control of her accelerating plunge. She had no idea how close she was to the ground. She thought about the children and how much they needed her. She had to get out of this, but she couldn't figure out what was wrong. If she knew what was happening, she could fix it. There was no other option. With only half of the canopy working, she pulled as hard as she could to bring her speed down. Out of nowhere, there was a loud metallic bang. Then everything went black. Before she even opened her eyes, the smell in the air hit her. She felt the soft ground beneath her. She moved her fingers and toes. When both responded, she felt a wave of relief. She was dizzy and carefully opened her eyes. She heard someone scream, "Oh, thank God, Vicky." It was her friend Kate from the centre, a trained doctor. She was aware of a blur of people surrounding her with worried expressions. There was the siren of an ambulance blaring in the distance. The world turned fuzzy and everything went black again. The next time she opened her eyes, she was strapped to a stretcher, her head in a brace. She was in a helicopter. The paramedic told her that they were about to land at Southampton. She wondered why they were going there and not to Salisbury, as it was closer. She felt embarrassed that so much effort and expense was just for her. It felt unnecessary. He told her that Southampton had a major trauma unit, which is why they had to be there. She felt it was overkill as she had done the checks on the ground and had no pain whatsoever. She felt sleepy again and drifted off. When she woke again, she was in A&E. For any American friends, A&E is accident and emergency. It's basically the British-Irish version of the ER emergency room. Everything seemed so surreal. She was in and out of consciousness. The next time she woke fully, she was in a bed in a large room. Emil was by her side. "Finally, you're awake," he said, with no hint of emotion. He didn't even rise from his seat. He asked how she was feeling and said they had been there for quite a while. She felt guilty and apologized for causing so much hassle. He didn't disagree. One of the consultants said she had broken her pelvis and that they had given her a pelvic binder to hold everything together until they could operate. Later, a nurse came by who thought it was too tight and went to loosen it. Victoria screamed in agony and shock as pain shot through her pelvis and it felt as though her body were going to rip in two. He quickly tightened it up again and the pain faded. She was horrified. She couldn't believe the pain. She wondered how hurt she actually was. A nurse told her that they were waiting for a bed in intensive care. She still felt it was an overreaction to a broken bone. Another doctor finally explained the true extent of her injuries. As well as the broken pelvis, they thought she had also damaged her bladder and she had broken most of her ribs along her right side and part of her right lung had collapsed. She was in disbelief. He told her she was very lucky to be alive. They didn't know yet if she had an unstable spinal fracture, so were going to put her in full spinal care to protect the spinal cord. Emil was next to her, looking bored. She silently pleaded with him to give her a hug and kiss to tell her he loved her, but he didn't. A nurse said they had to get her off the bed and onto a trolley, but it was going to hurt. There were five staff there ready to roll her. The second she moved even slightly to the side, her whole body was in flames and she screamed for them to stop. They had to persist, however, and it took everything for her not to resist. It was excruciating. When they finally got her on the trolley, she sobbed. She was traumatized by what just happened. When they got to the room, she begged to be left on the trolley, but they had to move her. She sounded like a wild animal as she screamed. Emile just looked on in silence as she was in the worst agony of her life. Once in the bed, she lay there in shock and couldn't breathe until the pain subsided. The doctor gave her a sympathetic pat and said the worst was over. The lack of attention from Emile was blazingly obvious. He could at least pretend. She was embarrassed by his obvious lack of interest. She was heartbroken to see the look on her father's face the next day. He did his best to hide it, but she could tell tensions were growing between him and Emile. She had surgery on her pelvis where they had to put it back together like a jigsaw. She felt completely lost just being stuck in that bed. She just wanted to see her kids. She finally had a FaceTime call with them. Being flat on her back all day was unbearable. Every few hours, the pain would build up and she would beg to be moved. This required a 5-man log roll to move her onto her good side to release the pressure that had built up from being on her back. She would try her hardest to last as long as she could on each side, but would find herself begging to be moved about every 3 hours. She was also extremely lonely. People would visit as often as they could, but Emile was rarely there. He insisted he hadn't been allowed any time off of work, which she found really hard to believe. She would instead spend each day looking forward to her parents' evening visits, where they would tell her how April and Ben were doing. On the rare occasions Emile would visit, the nurse always made a point of telling him he could visit any time he wanted, that he didn't have to stick to visitor hours, but he never took them up on their offer. This humiliated Victoria. She also knew her family and friends were picking up on his lack of interest, and she was so embarrassed. She tried to tell herself that people deal with things in different ways. Consultants were concerned about a burst fracture in her spine and said she would likely be in hospital for about 3 months while they assessed it. She said it wasn't possible and asked for alternatives. He said they could operate, but he was reluctant. She wanted the surgery and he said he would reassess and get back to her. Days went by with no word until Emile told her the doctor didn't want to do it. She wondered why he had spoken to Emile and not to her. She finally got a second opinion. The surgeon told her they would have to get her in an upright brace and do some weight-bearing x-rays. He also said they needed to address her drug addiction. She had barely felt any pain the whole time she had been in the ICU, as she had a button that could administer drugs to her. It was time to wean herself off. He said he would try her on the back brace as soon as she came off the fentanyl. She had a nurse come and remove the drug altogether, switched to tablets, and the next day the back brace was delivered. The physio came to help her. She felt sick as soon as she got to the slightest sitting position. She managed 2 minutes before needing to sit down. She asked the physio to leave her with the back brace on, so every hour she forced herself to sit up and timed how long she could last. By the time she was due for the x-ray the next day, she was able to swing her legs to the side of the bed and slowly stand up. The spinal surgeon couldn't believe it. She had hoped Emile might show up to support, but he was nowhere to be seen, which wasn't a surprise. One day the surgeon told her spine was stable and she wouldn't be needing any more surgeries. He also suggested she speak to a psychologist after everything she'd been through. However, on the day the psychologist visited her ward, Emile just happened to be there. He asked Victoria if she was okay with Emile staying, as he didn't seem to want to leave. She knew Emile would use it against her if she asked him to leave, so she said she was fine. After that, she didn't bother booking another appointment. Victoria was making fast progress physically and ended up turning a 3-month stay into a 2-week one. That is major, major, major strength. When she excitedly called Emile to tell him she would be home in a few days, he said it wasn't possible as he had too much on at work. He suggested several days after that. She was disappointed. She really wanted to see the kids. 3 days later, he finally came to take her home. She was still using the back brace, which had to be worn all the time, and she needed crutches to walk. As she got in the car, Emile slammed the door and barely acknowledged her the whole way home. But once she got back, she was overwhelmed by how amazing it was to be back with the kids. Victoria hadn't taken into account how much harder it would be to recover at home. Everything had to be done for her there. Now she was struggling to keep up. She tried to be more helpful for Emile, but he would seem annoyed that she couldn't do anything right and needed so much help. Like, can you imagine that? Like, you've gone through the most major traumatic accident and your husband is annoyed at you for needing a little bit of extra help and you feel guilty for it. When she tried to do the night feeds with Ben, he just told her to go back to sleep and there was no point in her being up. It felt like such a blow to her stomach. She felt unneeded and unwanted and completely worthless. And even like as a mother too, I feel like that would be so hard to not even be able to fully take care of your own child. And then like your husband is just making you feel even worse for that. When it is not your fault that this crazy thing happened to you. So eventually Emil started being more engaging with her and would even occasionally give her a cuddle on the couch. She enjoyed it while it lasted, as she knew she was completely reliant on him. One weekend they received a call from the British Parachute Association saying they were paying them a visit. She knew both of the visitors, as she had worked with them previously. They were letting her know that they were starting an investigation into her accident. They said there were slinks missing in her parachute. She was stunned. It was the first time she'd even considered what had happened in the accident, and so she had so many more things out to worry about. They were thinking that it was only the pressure from the brake line pushing against the other lines that kept the parachute inflated enough for her to survive. She had been a hair's breadth away from being killed. She broke down, the news hitting her like a ton of bricks. A few days later, her friend Alex from the centre called her saying they had been talking with the chief instructor and were concerned. They weren't sure it was an accident. When they looked over the parachute and the rig, something just didn't add up. They said that with her permission, they were going to report it to the police to investigate it properly. Victoria knew she had to talk to Emil first, as he would blame her if all hell broke loose. When she told him, he put his arm around her and said she should do it to put everyone at the parachute centre's mind at rest, so she gave her consent. They didn't hear anything for a few weeks, so she put the investigation to the back of her mind. One morning, she was giving Ben his breakfast when Emil ran down the stairs saying he was late for work and would see her later. But then, he never came home. There was a knock at the door. It was two inspectors. She started to panic, thinking something bad had happened to Emil, when they told her he had been arrested on suspicion of attempted murder. It just didn't make sense. She asked to speak to him, but he was being questioned at the station, and she was informed that she wouldn't be able to speak to him for the duration of the investigation. She asked why they suspected him, but they wouldn't tell her anymore. She too had to come to the station, so she got a friend to take care of the kids while she waited for her father to drive down from Scotland. They asked her about the day of the accident, what she remembered, and how her marriage to Emil was. She lied and said it was fine. They asked her if there was any point before the jump where he had been alone with the parachute, and suddenly she remembered. He had taken April to the toilet with it and had been gone for quite a while. Before she left, they downloaded all her texts from Emil. She felt mortified at the thought of her marriage being laid bare like that. She realised she was now completely helpless and couldn't take care of the kids alone. She felt like she was in a nightmare, but just knew that Emil was innocent. When the police came back to the house a few days later, they told her he was at his army accommodation and the conditions of his bail were that he were to have no contact with her and couldn't enter Wiltshire. They also said they had new information she needed to know. When they had searched Emil's room at the barracks, they found pictures of his girlfriend, but nothing of Victoria and the kids. He'd been having an affair for a while and they were planning on moving in together. In text to this woman, he had told her he was leaving Victoria because she had cheated on him and Ben wasn't even his son. He had also accrued a lot of debt. Every word they said cut deeper and deeper. She ripped her wedding rings off and flung them across the room. Her dad tried to calm her down, but she couldn't even think straight as she sobbed hysterically, completely humiliated. She said she wanted to make another statement. She ranted for hours. All of the problems she had had with him over the years came out. She couldn't stop. Afterwards, she felt empty, alone, and angry. Her intuition about him had been right, which made her feel so much worse now. The detective told her the reserve parachute's error had come from the failure of two crucial loops and asked if this could have been an accident in her opinion. She tried to find a feasible explanation, but she shook her head. No, slinks just did not break. They asked her if anything else odd had happened recently, and she suddenly recalled the gas leak and how odd and uptight Emil had been about it. So she told them everything about it. She eventually had a rota of people helping her out, but her recovery was a long and lonely process. When the kids were in bed every evening, that was when she would be left alone to think. She was also facing scrutiny from the media and had even had someone she knew take quotes about Emil's arrest from her private Facebook and sell them to the papers. Physically, she was growing stronger, but so was the chaos around her. Social services had visits with the kids every 10 days, and she had to attend monthly meetings where there would be a social worker and healthcare worker and a rep from April's nursery. She couldn't help but wonder if the police were using them as the eyes and ears on her house. She felt she was being treated as a criminal, as she had restrictions placed on her about leaving the house. Ben was now allowed sporadic visits with the kids. She felt she was the only one who wasn't allowed to see him. The police arrived one day with a team to search their property. A gas specialist checked the cooker and the dried blood around the lever. It was traumatizing and she felt helpless and frustrated. She still couldn't entertain the thought that Emil was a murderer. After 4 months of not seeing Emil, they told her he was now being arrested for her attempted murder with the gas leak, and because the kids were in the house at the time, he was now allowed zero access to them. April and Ben were also being placed on the child protection register. After a few months, he began being allowed to see them again at a centre with a supervisor. She tried to again imagine a world where Emil would want to kill her. It was as though she were thinking of two different people, the original Emil who she had fallen in love with, who was intensely caring and loving, then the other Emil who was cold and detached. Were either of them capable of killing her? It just did not seem possible. But still, she had begun having nightmares that he was standing over her as she slept. She struggled with day-to-day life and felt she was going through the motions for the sake of the kids. One day, Ben burned his head badly on a radiator when trying to pull himself up. Victoria rushed him to A&E. The nurse looked at the computer and Victoria noticed her face fell and she left the room saying she would be back in a minute. She could see her talking on a phone through the window and when she came back, her manner had changed. It turned out that Ben was flagged on the system as being on the protection register. It dawned on Victoria that the nurse thought that she had hurt her own child. She had to wait for hours on the ward for the consultant to check Ben over for any signs of abuse. He told her she then had to go back to the Children's Social Services for authorization before she could go home. It was humiliating and she tried not to break down. When she got home, she once again felt defeated. It was January 2017, almost 2 years after the fall, when CPS finally made a decision. Emil was being formally charged with her attempted murder on two counts and reckless endangerment of the children's lives. She felt her world crash around her. Reality started to hit. There was clearly enough compelling evidence to charge him. What has she done to deserve this? She still went over everything in her mind, questioning if he had actually done it. Her friends tried to tell her he must have done it, but it just made her feel worse. She hated being told what to believe, and it made her feel backed into a corner. She would snap back that she didn't need constant reminding of all the bad things he had done to her. She still believed that being a bad husband didn't make you a murderer. Which I do agree with. In October 2017, the trial began. She wouldn't be allowed in the courtroom until after she had stood as a witness. She spent the day anxiously checking news updates. She saw articles about her and what had happened. Then she saw one which read, Emil Sillars had started an affair with Stephanie Goller after meeting her on Tinder and WhatsApp messages. Sillars lied that Victoria had given birth to a child that was not his as a result of an affair. The jury also heard that Sillars was involved in a sexual relationship with his ex-wife, Carly. Hearing more details about his affairs made her sick, but learning about Carly completely floored her. They had never been friends, but she thought that they had some kind of relationship. She had been on hand to help Victoria with childcare when she needed to attend her medical appointments. The article went on to say that in 2015, Emil had debts of around £22,000 and allegedly believed he would receive £120,000 from an insurance policy in the event of Victoria's death. It made her question his innocence again. The chief instructor at the parachute centre had said in court that she felt she had landed, that the field she had landed in was soft due to being freshly ploughed, and that combined with her light weight and the low jump contributed to her survival. It said it was extremely unlikely the slings would have come off mid-fall and that the paramedics had not taken them off when tending to her. They discussed Emil going to the bathroom with April in detail. The prosecution lawyer stated there would have been no reason to take the parachute to the bathroom as it was bulky and heavy. The weather ended up being bad, but he knew he couldn't put the tampered with the parachute back in the store, so he instead arranged to keep it in Victoria's locker overnight, which was against normal procedure. Finally, it was Victoria's turn to take the stand. Emil had been placed as far from her as possible so she couldn't see him and chose not to look in his direction. She was as honest as she could be about everything, even when it came to questions about her marriage. They showed her thousands of texts from Emil's phone to Stephanie's. She read texts saying things like, "Will you call me your Mr. Grey? I will sacrifice and give up so much for you. I just never want to let you go. From April onwards, I can do random and spontaneous. To be with you, I would do anything." Why from April onwards, she asked herself, knowing the accident had happened the first weekend of April. He had also been texting Carly things like, "So tonight we fuck twice." Knowing Carly had gone behind her back somehow felt worse. She wondered if she had gotten some sick satisfaction from it because her own marriage to him hadn't worked. He had been texting Stephanie while she was giving birth to Ben and while she was lying in hospital after the fall. When asked if she believed Emile would have murdered her for financial gain, she said he had his faults, but to an extent he loved her and would have at least considered the children, that he's an amazing father and wouldn't have done that to them. She heard details about his frequent visits to sex clubs and swingers groups. He'd arranged to meet a sex worker in the week before the fall. Listening to the news one evening, she heard that Emile had suggested a stranger had tried to kill her. After 6 weeks, the trial was coming to a close and the jurors sent to deliberate. Reports of bullying in the jury were all over the press, with two jurors being discharged due to stress. After 8 days, the judge ordered a retrial as they were unable to reach a verdict. 5 months later, at the retrial, Emile was found guilty on 2 counts of attempted murder and a 3rd count of recklessly endangering life. In a statement to the cameras outside the court, an investigator she recognised said, "I think the real danger with Emile Sillars is he is cold, calculated. What he did was deliberate and done for financial and sexual motives, and there was absolutely no consideration of his wife or anyone else. He serves his own needs, and that makes him a very dangerous man, in my opinion." Victoria was finally allowed to speak to him after the verdict. She also went to visit him in prison. He looked worn and older than she remembered. She asked him a lot of questions. He said none of it was her fault. He denied trying to kill her twice. He cried, and she still didn't know whether to believe him or not. He was a broken man, and leaving the prison, she felt a mix of relief and sorrow. She attended his sentencing, where the judge said, "Emile is a danger to the public. This was wicked offending of extreme gravity. Your offending was extremely serious. There were 2 attempts to murder your wife. They were planned and carried out in cold blood for your own selfish purposes, which include financial gain. You have shown yourself to be a person of quite exceptional callousness who will stop at nothing to satisfy his own desires, material or otherwise. Nor have you shown the slightest sign of remorse. That your wife survived at all was miraculous. She undoubtedly suffered severe physical harm and must have suffered psychological harm, both in the terror of the fall and since. She appears to have recovered from her physical injuries, but not having seen her in the box at great length from the psychological harm. You will serve a minimum of 18 years behind bars." Once Emile went to prison, he began bombarding her with letters and phone calls. At first she responded as he sounded like the old Emile. But soon the controlling Emile began to come forth, and it was the first time she'd been able to see his control clearly. He begged her to come visit him, but she refused. He said no one else would come see him, and she was all he had left. But she grew stronger over the months and stopped engaging with him. She began to accept he was abusive, and it was the most difficult thing to process. It took time on her own to fully accept he'd been trying to kill her. She had seen just how sinister and insidious domestic abuse could be. All she wanted now was freedom. When she thinks about him now, she feels detached. I completely understand that feeling. Victoria ended up doing another jump and felt all the joy she had first felt when trying the sport. Emile still to this day tries to come after her for money, being particularly focused on getting a share of her house. Victoria is set to remarry this year. And that is the story of Victoria Sillars. It is a frightening one. It is an upsetting one. I think it gives a really great example of how these, you know, strong women get sucked in by these men. Gaslighting, I think it's the most fantastic examples of gaslighting, of control, of manipulation. And I'm just really glad that she survived, and she seems to be doing really well, and I'm glad that her kids are okay. And if you would like to purchase her memoir about her story, which I got pretty much the majority of this from, I have left a link in the episode bio. It's a really interesting read. Obviously, I couldn't fit everything in. There's a lot more things there. So definitely check that out. It's a really, really important book. So that's all I got. I'm so excited to be back. I really missed doing this. I'm glad I'm in the best mental headspace again to start doing this, and I'm already working on my next episode. I'm gonna again try and get one of these out for you every 2 weeks. Tuesday morning should be when it drops, and thank you so much for listening, and I really appreciate you guys if you've hung around waiting for these episodes. I appreciate you so much, because I know how annoying it is when podcasts you listen to suddenly stop coming out with episodes. And I'm going to continue to do more work online as well. I'm working on possibly in the future doing videoed podcasts for YouTube. I know people, a lot of people seem to really like seeing the visuals and seeing the person speaking. They find it easier to focus that way. I kind of like not being on camera. I don't mind the thought of doing it if it's something that you guys want. So let me know if that's something that you would be interested in. Once again, reach out to me on social media. I'm either at IPV and Me or at Mandgogs, MANDGOGGS. You can always email me, IPVandMePodcast@gmail.com. And take care of each other. And I hope you guys are doing well. And I will see you in 2 weeks.